Hey, this is Chris from PleasureMechanics.com, and this week on Speaking of Sex, we have part two of our interview with Emily Nagoski, PhD, author of Come As You Are, the surprising new science that will transform your sex life. Part one aired last week, and if you missed it, go back and listen to it first. You can find it at PleasureMechanics.com/Nagoski, N-A-G-O-S-K-I, and you'll find part one there where we talk about pleasure and the surprising truths about sexual anatomy. And now on to part two, where we start by diving into the question, is sex a drive? And Emily is going to explain to us why sex is not a drive and what it in fact is. Here is part two of our interview with Emily Nagoski.
I love food metaphors.
Okay. And I struggle with food metaphors because sex is not a drive.
Ooh. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because that's another one of those things you debunk, this idea of the sex drive.
Yeah, it's a big deal for me. I don't know how much anyone else besides me cares, but I really feel like it's important that we all let go. And I know it's a very convenient, comfortable thing to say, sex drive, but sex is not a drive. So the reason this is important is, so here's what a drive is. A drive is where you have an uncomfortable internal experience that pushes you out into the world to go fix your return to a comfortable baseline state. So hunger acts as a drive very often. You get an uncomfortable internal experience, hunger, that pushes you out into the world to go get food. And then you get full and you return to the allostatic baseline, right? Thirst is the same way. Your fluid levels get too low, you consume fluids and your fluid levels return to baseline and you feel satisfied, right? And drives are all about survival. If you don't do these things as an organism, you will literally die. So to call sex a drive is to say that if you don't get the sex, then you're going to die. And as Frank Beach, the behavioral researcher from the 1950s, pointed out, nobody ever died because they couldn't get laid. Sex is not a drive. It is not an uncomfortable internal experience that pushes you out into the world so that you can survive. It is instead an incentive motivation system. When to say sex incentive motivation system is less fun than saying drive, I know that. So I've been looking for language that's as fun as drive. But so what that means is there's some appetitive, desirable external stimulus that pulls you out into the world, some goal that you would like to attain, some delicious something or other that you're moved toward by how desirable it is. Does that make sense?
It does.
So it works not like hunger, but like curiosity.
And yet some people would say, if I don't get laid soon, I'm going to die.
Yeah, and there absolutely are times for some people where it feels, how come, Emily, it feels like an uncomfortable internal experience. And there's this whole other mechanism. This is one of the things I learned about right before I started writing the book. When I learned about it, I was like, okay, this is maybe the most important idea I have learned in the last 10 years. And it is the criterion velocity and discrepancy reducing feedback loop, which I can translate that into English. I call it the little monitor. So here's the thing. You've got this little monitor in your emotional brain that knows what your goal is. It knows how much effort you're investing and it knows how much progress you're making, right? And it's got this ratio. This little monitor has a ratio of progress to effort. Mm-hmm. And it has a very strong opinion about what that ratio should be. So when you're putting in just a little bit of effort and making a whole lot of progress towards your goal, how does that feel?
Yay.
Yeah, it's awesome. Like if you're driving to the mall. In America, it takes 20 minutes to get to the mall. It doesn't matter where you are. It takes 20 minutes, right? So you get in the car and you're getting all the green lights and there's no traffic and you're zipping right through. It feels hugely rewarding and great. But if there's a lot of traffic and you're getting a lot of red lights, you begin to get frustrated because it's taking longer than it is supposed to take, right? It's more effortful than it should be. Mm. And if there's a big accident and you're just like sitting there parked on the highway, you move beyond frustration and into rage. And then eventually you cross a threshold, the little monitor crosses a threshold from believing your goal state is attainable to the belief that the goal state, going to the mall or whatever, is not attainable. And it pushes you off an emotional cliff into the pit of despair. And you just abandon all hope and give up. When they do research on rats, okay, this is a much longer answer than you probably wanted it to be. But the little monitor, basically, so if we apply this to sex, what we get is, So take orgasm for, well, no, we're talking about sex being a drive, sexual desire. So in the context of sexual desire, if a person believes that sex is supposed to be a certain level of difficulty to obtain, and it takes more than that for them to get sex, then they begin to get frustrated. And that is the uncomfortable internal experience. It's not the desire for sex itself that's uncomfortable. It's people's frustration about it being more challenging to obtain the sex that they want than they expect it is supposed to take.
And so is this one of the things that leads to sexless marriages when people stop initiating and stop trying after too much rejection?
I think it can be. So I think when you look at the structure of the system, of the discrepancy of the little monitor, what it tells us is there's three ways that we can create change, right? One, we can change the goal. Is this actually the right goal for me? We can change the kind or quantity of effort we're investing, or we can change the opinion, the criterion velocity itself. How difficult is this goal supposed to be? So when it comes to one of the reasons why sex goes away in relationships, part of it is that people are finding they have to invest more effort and a totally different kind of effort from what they thought they were supposed to have to invest. I was at a conference about a year and a half ago, and I was talking about responsive desire and the dual control model with this woman who was sitting next to me at the conference at lunch. And she said, could you please tell my husband that so that he can stop asking me if I want to have sex in the morning when I'm in the middle of changing the baby's diaper? Do you want to have sex tonight? No. The answer is no. The kind of effort he's investing in initiating sex is not the kind of effort that is going to get him where he wants to go. Mm-hmm. And he means well. How great that he's actually asking, right? But he's asking in a way and in a context that is unlikely to get him what it is he's actually looking for. So sometimes really what it takes is learning better strategies for getting where you want to go.
I love it. And I think this is what your book really shines in, is taking these kind of complex ideas and making them applicable to our everyday lives. And I want to get back to orgasm, because you have so much great advice about women who are struggling with orgasm. And we hear specifically from a lot of women who have orgasms alone, but not with partners.
Yes.
What does some of your scientific research point to why that would be?
So I think most of the time it comes down to the accelerator and brakes thing, right? If a person can have an orgasm on their own, that means that the accelerator and brake are fully functional in that particular context. But then you change the context, say you put a partner in the room, and that changes what the brake has to respond to. So very often, I've also heard from women who can orgasm when their partners are there, but cannot orgasm on their own. Mm-hmm. So it really is just a matter of like what your individual brain learns to respond to is sexually relevant versus a potential threat. And for a lot of women, having your partner in the room increases your level of self-consciousness, and that keeps the brake on. And again, it doesn't matter how hard you hit the accelerator. If the brakes are on, you're not going to get there. So it takes the process of teaching your brain that, look, you're totally safe. You can relax and you don't have to respond with the brakes to having your partner in the room, which is why gradual systematic desensitization type interventions can be so effective. It's a gentle way of teaching your brake, look, this isn't a threat. You can get all the way to orgasm and you're totally safe and it's nothing to worry about and it can feel really good.
And what does that process look like? Is it a matter of reprogramming your brain with new messages or is there something else?
It's practice. It's recrobing your entire body. So the first week, so if it's across weeks, the first week you would try just, you know, masturbating the way you usually do on your own. And then the second week you have a picture of your partner face down in the room with you. And then the week after that, you masturbate several times a week with the picture of your partner face up in the room with you. But the lights are off, so you can't actually see it. And then the next week, the picture's there, face up, and the lights are on. So very gradually, you're exposing your body and brain to simultaneous orgasm arousal and also increasingly close the presence of your partner.
Wow.
And you can use Skype as a gradual process. You can use having your partner there in the dark, but with candles in the room. And then the next week, with your partner, with candles in the room and one candle lit. So gradually, really gradually, but your partner not touching you, just in the room. And then gradually they're on the bed with you, and then they're touching you, but not doing the genital sensations. You do that yourself. with the gradual increase in sensitivity.
Amazing. That is gradual.
It is. And not everybody needs to do it that gradually. Yeah. Some people, once they recognize that what's happening is their partner there is hitting the brakes, they can just be like, oh, well, I completely trust my partner. That's all nonsense. That's just cultural crap that I absorbed. Let me let that go. And it happens right away.
Right. We talked recently to a woman who had so much kind of Catholic shame that she felt her mother was in the bedroom with her. And we kind of gave her permission to kick her mother out of bed and start reevaluating her own values around premarital sex. And it's interesting to hear back from these people who, just with permission, can change their mindset and start changing their scripts. Mm-hmm. And so I think this idea of the changeability and malleability of our sexuality over a lifetime is really important, because so many people do feel stuck in their struggle or stuck in a rut and feel kind of hopeless. And all of this information and all of these theories give us hope that we can change. And that's so important.
Mm-hmm. And that's a really great example of the individual differences. Because if a person has a very sensitive break, it will be a slower process for them to let go of these things. Uh-huh. A person with just an ordinary average kind of break will let go of things more readily.
Right. And especially once you start identifying the specific factors that are causing that break to trigger, you get to discover your own path again. Mm-hmm. We hear a lot about clitoral orgasms versus vaginal orgasms. And some people love making these lists of all the different kinds of orgasms women can have. What do you make of this? Are there different types of orgasms or just different experiences of various combinations of sensations?
Right. Oh, I have such a strong opinion about this.
I love it.
My strong opinion, and I looked at a lot of research. I actually had to change my definition of orgasm after I did the research for the book. And so the definition I came to for the book is the spontaneous, involuntary release of sexual tension. That's it. So you'll notice there's no mention of any genital or other body parts. There's no mention of any physical sensations. It's just the spontaneous, involuntary release of sexual sensations or sexual tension. It's not even necessarily pleasurable, right? Because orgasm can happen in almost any context. And, you know, if somebody tries to tickle you when you're in a great state of mind, it can be fun. But if somebody tickles you when you're in a pissed off state of mind, you don't like it, right? Orgasm is the same way. If you have an orgasm when you're in a great sex positive state of mind, it can feel awesome. If you have an orgasm when you're in a terrible pissed off state of mind, it doesn't necessarily feel so good, right? So you can't even include pleasure necessarily in your definition of orgasm. And the reason I don't talk about any genitals is because orgasm is orgasm is orgasm. Women can have orgasms. Anybody can have orgasms from all kinds of different body parts being stimulated. Their breasts and their feet and their clitorises and their vaginas and their anuses and their stomachs. And just by thinking about it or just by flexing their pubococcygeal muscle. And are we going to call each one of these orgasms a different kind of orgasm? Or can we just say that they are all orgasms and they are all great? That is my strong opinion. Freud had this idea and he just invented it. He just decided that because patriarchy, therefore orgasm during intercourse is the good kind and orgasm from clitoral stimulation is the immature kind. And it was literally just his opinion of a Victorian European middle-aged male. He was just inventing shit. He was making it up. Why are we still paying attention to any of that shit? He said some really important, cool stuff. All the stuff about the unconscious, really, really important. Let's not dismiss Freud entirely, but let's dismiss everything Freud had to say about the clitoris. Yeah. White dude Freud from the Victorian era doesn't have a useful opinion about the clitoris.
Well, now it seems like sex educators get in this battle of is ejaculation more enlightened than another kind of orgasm? And
oh, for God's sake, really?
It's very divisive, I think, to create a hierarchy of orgasms being more meaningful, depending on what kind of orgasm they are. And yet we're prone to do it, and it drives me nuts.
Why are we, like, why is there a better or worse? Why is there a right or wrong orgasm? How come, and why is it orgasm anyway that's our threshold? Like, why do we have to cross into the spontaneous release of tension when pleasure is awesome whether or not you have an orgasm?
Absolutely. That's why we're the pleasure mechanics and not the orgasm mechanics.
Exactly. Which I love. But it's really, we have this very complicated relationship with pleasure. Like, you're not allowed to have pleasure unless it's for a purpose or unless you punish yourself afterward. So one of the challenges I've had teaching about sex is I am thoroughly on board with the orgasm is a byproduct. It's not an evolutionary adaptation. It doesn't serve any reproductive function. It's just a fantastic bonus from an evolutionary point of view. And I have students who hate that idea because they feel like it's making orgasm less important. That what I'm saying when I say it's not an evolutionary adaptation is that it's not valuable. I mean, historically, scientists were all men and probably all dickheads. And that is a little bit what the historical remnant is. But to be not an evolutionary adaptation just means it doesn't serve a reproductive function. And sex doesn't have to have a reproductive function. Pleasure doesn't have to have a reproductive function in order to be valuable and important. What it has to have in order to be valuable and important is the person who's having its sense that it's important. Does that make sense?
It does. And, you know, we really talk a lot about pleasure for its own sake, touch without intercourse as the goal. And one of the reasons we focus so much on full body touch is because what we know about how stress affects our sex lives. So I would love your thoughts on the relationship between stress and libido, stress and the ability to experience sexual pleasure. How big of a threat do you think stress is to people's sex lives?
Stress is in the top five. And it's different depending on who you are. Yet another example of individual differences. So for about 80% of people, stress, depression, anxiety hits the brakes. It decreases your interest in sex. For the remaining 20%, it can actually increase your interest in sex. People just vary. I call them flatliners and redliners. And it's just, and it, there are some things about sensitivity of the brakes and gas that can be predictive of it, but basically people just vary. So if you're in the group that where when you're stressed out, it decreases your interest in sex, man, we have this really stupid culture around stress that says you just like get rid of your stress as though it just disappears automatically and spontaneously. And we don't get that stress is a physiological event that is happening inside your body. And it is designed. So can I tell the whole like you're being chased by a lion story?
Sure.
Okay, because, I mean, I have a whole half a chapter specifically on stress. It was, I had this complicated couple of months with my editor trying really hard to make the case that I needed to have two whole chapters in the book that are not about sex in my book about women's sexuality. Because women's sexual response and sexual pleasure are so dependent on the other factors of their life that you cannot talk about women's sexual well-being without talking about their overall well-being, without talking about their relationship and their trust and their overall attitudes toward bodies and their self-criticism and their self-confidence and their stress and their love.
Yes.
You can't understand how women work sexually unless you understand how sex is integrated into the rest of their lives. So I have a whole half a chapter specifically on stress, and it's really important to me. So, okay, I'm going to talk about stress. Okay, so here I go. So stress is not the same thing as your stressors. Your stressors are the things out there in the environment that activate the stress in your body. So for a lot of us, that'll be our jobs, potentially our families or other relationships. Your own thoughts, your self-critical thoughts are stressors, right? So these are things that activate the stress response, which is this evolutionarily adaptive mechanism designed to help you survive being chased by a lion, right? So the stressor comes in the environment of evolutionary adaptiveness, it's something like a lion. And when you're being chased by a lion, what do?
Obi?
Yeah.
You run.
You run. That's right. And there's only two possible outcomes here. The lion chases you, you start to run, and either you get eaten by the lion, in which case none of the rest of this matters, or you survive. You run back to your village. This is the environment of evolutionary adaptiveness, right? So you run back to your village, and everyone in the village helps you to kill the lion, and you have the lion for dinner, and you take the parts of the carcass you're not going to use. The next morning, you bury it in an honoring ceremony, holding hands with everyone in your tribe, giving thanks for the lion's sacrifice. And at the end of all that, you hug your tribe members, and how do you feel?
Better.
glad to be alive. You're grateful. You love your friends and family. That is the whole stress response cycle, right? That's how it's supposed to work. We almost never get chased by lions anymore, which is great in its way, but it means that if your stressor is not a lion but is your boss, you don't actually get to run away from or beat the shit out of your boss. Am I allowed to swear? I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
Beat the shit out of your boss. So if you're feeling stressed out by your boss, what should you do? Physical activity is the thing that communicates to your body that you have successfully escaped the stressor. The fastest shortcut to teaching your body that you are now safe is any kind of physical activity, even if it's just going for a walk. It can be a Zumba class. It can be dancing around in your underwear in your bedroom. Any form of physical activity helps to teach your body that you are safe because it's the physiological equivalent of running away from a lion. It helps you to complete the stress response cycle so that you can be in that place where you feel grateful and you love your friends and family and you're glad to be alive. So stress is not a thing that you just turn off. It's a process you have to move through. It's a biological cascade that your body wants to complete. It knows how to complete it. It just needs you to give it a little bit of help.
And where would massage fit in? Because that's not a physical activity of exertion, but many people find it to be super relaxing. Why did that work?
So there's an additional stress response mechanism. What I was just talking about is fight or flight. And there's two other really important stress response systems. And massage is the tend and befriend stress response mechanism. So in this case, it's not so much that when you're being chased by a lion, you run. It's that when you are under attack in some way, humans as an ultra social species survive best when we are with our tribe so they can protect us and we can protect them. So when your body is stressed out, it pushes you to go be with your tribe. And literally, physical touch changes our chemistry out of the stress response into the relaxation response. When it's happening in a context with a person that we feel really trusting with, and when we feel like we're in a safe place and can relax.
Interesting. And so this is my kind of uber geeky question about all of this is by clearing, going into the parasympathetic mode of the nervous system, clearing out stress from the sympathetic nervous system, does that clear the way for arousal to take on the sympathetic nervous system?
It's a little more complicated than that because there's sort of two. So, I mean, insert the polyvagal theory here. Basically, the way people traditionally get taught about sympathetic versus parasympathetic is that sympathetic is gas pedal stress and parasympathetic is brakes, relaxation, good. But actually, and that's partly true. That's a chunk of the picture, but a really important other chunk of the picture is that final stress response that I mentioned, which is the freeze stress response. So there's flight, which is running away, fight, which is anger and attack, tend befriend, which is connecting socially, and there is freeze. So when you're in a life threat situation, you're in the middle of the sympathetic activation, this like runaway stress response. When you get into a life threat situation, the brakes slam on and shut you down right in the middle. So this is the experience of trauma. People experience tonic immobility. When you have experienced long-term abuse, even in your history or in your relationship right now, your body will begin to choose this stress response as the default stress response sometimes. And we learn to shut down. So that parasympathetic stress response does not facilitate arousal. It locks everything down and you feel permanently unsafe inside your own body. And in the same way that you gradually learn to have orgasm, you gradually learn to relax the break and allow it to come up and learn that you can feel safe inside your own body. I just read the most amazing book called The Body Keeps the Score, which talks about this in an incredibly clear way. And if you've experienced trauma in your life, I so recommend this book by Bessel van der Kolk. It's amazing and great. But in general, what you want is to allow the sympathetic activation to run its course so that you're not hitting the gas pedal and you're not hitting the brakes. You want to be coasting. And that's the context where arousal and pleasure can really thrive.
Beautifully said. Thank you. I want to ask you really quickly, this book is primarily about female sexuality and orgasm. Do you have a take on men's sexuality? Is it as simple as we make it out to be, or is that too a myth?
Well, so my perspective on this is that people of all bodies are made of all the same parts, just organized in a different way. And even though there are some predictable patterns, like when you look at a set of female genitals you can sort of see that there's a pattern there that's different from the set of male genitals, even though the male and female genitals are made of all the same parts, they're organized in these predictable ways. To a lesser extent, there are predictable patterns of organization for female sexuality than for male sexuality. I would describe the male sexual response pattern as being more robust and less sensitive to context, whereas the female pattern is more sensitive to external factors. In the same way, the reason we have female hormonal contraception and not male hormonal contraception is that it's sort of easy to disrupt the female reproductive system, whereas it takes a whole lot. It takes a sledgehammer to disrupt the male reproductive system. Wow. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's, it's not that they're simple, it's that they're organized in a different way.
Beautiful. Will it be your next book?
I know, God. I mean, that's like asking a person who's just given birth what their next child's going to be named.
I asked my wife the day after our daughter was born if we could have another.
Were you the person who gave birth?
No. She was up for it, though.
Alrighty then.
Well, thank you so much for writing this book. It is a true gift to us all. It's available now, called Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life, and I highly recommend it. Can you share with our listeners where they can find you online if they want to learn more?
Sure. I'm on Twitter at Emily Nagoski. I'm on Instagram, which is hilarious and I love it, at E Nagoski. My blog is thedirtynormal.com. Also I have emilynagoski.com where you'll find my book tour calendar. So I'll be going all around North America, visiting places and doing talks. And you can come see me in real life and it's going to be awesome.
Oh, that would be amazing. So listeners, definitely check that out. Get the book and go visit Emily in person if you can. Emily, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Big thanks to Emily Nagoski for sharing her wisdom with us in this two-part interview series. You can find all of the show notes at pleasuremechanics.com/Nagoski, N-A-G-O-S-K-I. And we have a link to her book and her website so you can find out more from this amazing thinker in the field of sex. We'll be back with you next week for another episode of Speaking of Sex. And come over to pleasuremechanics.com so you will always be the first to find out about our new offerings and receive your exclusive discounts and bonuses and more. We would love to have you on our free weekly newsletter so we can be in touch. If you have questions you want to submit for future episodes of Speaking of Sex, come on over to pleasuremechanics.com and hit the Ask Us Anything button. We are always one click away. We'll talk to you next week. This is Chris from Pleasure Mechanics wishing you a lifetime of pleasure. Cheers.